There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel. I'm your host on today's program, HD Radio, also known as Digital Radio or IBOC. Anyway, you slice it, it's going to change their radio airways, but we're not sure if it's for the better. My guest to talk about this is my pal John Anderson from DIYmedia.net. and Free Press's Media Minutes. We're going to take the whole half hour on this, but we'll make sure that at the end, you know just a little bit more. So do stay tuned. John, thank you for joining me again today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Especially on a day when my voice is failing me.
Yes,
it's that. Mid-February, you think you're going to get out of the winter season without getting the cold. Then the temperatures here in central Illinois hit 60 and knocked me flat on my tuchus.
Really? Yeah, it's the temperature change. This whole 30 degrees in 24 hours thing is not cool.
So those of you listening to the program in Florida and California, do count yourselves lucky.
Yes, very much so.
Do count yourselves lucky. So, John, one of the things we want to talk about on today's show is IBOC and so-called HD radio. But first, actually, you were just at an interesting grassroots media conference in New York City this past weekend.
Yes, it was the third annual New York City Grassroots Media Conference, and it essentially is a big convergence of independent media makers and other social justice activists from throughout the five boroughs and the surrounding metropolitan area. And it tends to attract a couple other, you know, folks from out of town like myself. I was actually invited to go out there and do a presentation on micro radio tactical overview and operation. So we set up a 40-watt micro radio station in the New School University building, one of their main buildings with the classrooms in it, and gave a little spiel about how easy it is to put a station on the air, how much it costs, and how you can avoid getting busted by the FCC to get your message out.
And you've been studying this for more than 10 years.
Yeah,
now, right?
And the whole theme of the conference was figuring out ways to engage independent media makers with social justice movements. So things like living wage campaigns, various other labor type of campaigns, special interest single issue campaigns, ways that these people can use various forms of media, whether they be traditional like radio, television. There was actually even a panel on engaging the mainstream media, kind of, you know, publicity and PR type thing, all the way to, you know, setting up your own micro radio station, setting up your own blog, how to do that, how to podcast. It was kind of all over the place. It was just a day long. It was on the Saturday of last weekend. And then we had lots of snow.
And yeah, then you got the big blizzard.
The blizzard of 06, which really brought out the best in New Yorkers, I must say.
It always does.
It was beautiful.
It always does.
But it was a good time. I got to hook up with a lot of friends who've since moved out to New York. Some of the people that I used to work with on other media projects are now working for places like Democracy Now!
Right, so you got to see John Hamilton, who is he a producer now?
He's a producer with Democracy Now! The chief engineer of Democracy Now!, Mike DiFilippo, is the one that actually invited me to come out there, and so we got to hang out and got to see a nice part of a nice chunk of the city. It was a lot of fun. I wish it was a little longer, because it was a lot to pack into a single day, but the attendance was pretty good. I would estimate several hundred people. I think they were looking for anywhere between 800 and 1,000.
Wow.
The panels were pretty much jam-packed. The rooms were even kind of too small. Overall, logistically, it went off well, and I think people learned something. Let's hope we planted some seeds.
And they've done this before,
yes,
correct?
Yes, this was the third.
This is the third.
Yeah.
And are they really trying to keep it to New York City? Trying not? I mean, I guess that would be always be the question, because it could create it bigger, but then it gets harder to serve the sort of the surrounding community.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to look at New York as being kind of an entity in and of itself.
Bigger than many countries.
Yeah, with the amount of people that they have doing the type of work that was being featured at this thing, I think it would be pretty unmanageable if they wanted to do some sort of like, you know, annual nationwide thing. I mean, there's already conferences like that. For example, Clamor Magazine puts on the Allied Media Conference,
which gets about the same pull.
Right.
I mean, granted, everyone has to come into
Ohio,
to Northwest Ohio.
So you definitely don't have the nightlife and the excitement that you have in New York City. But no, I think that they were intentionally trying to keep it focused on issues that may be appearing in New York. But it wasn't, you know, like, they weren't New York-centric, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was more about just the community in New York getting together and exchanging ideas, more than it was about trying to focus all of the presentations on New York-centric type issues.
Right, and this is the kind of thing I think that people could do anywhere. I mean, and certainly there are regional conferences that are like that. There are a lot of anarchist book fairs that happen, especially along the West Coast and up in Canada, which have similar sorts of themes. They do a lot of media making. There's like the Portland Zine Symposium, which I've attended, which also has similar themes, similar workshops, although a little bit more focused on publishing, you know, self-publishing.
And let's face it, I mean, for those of us who do travel around the country occasionally to go to these types of things, it's just still a small world.
Yeah,
you know,
it's funny how small of a world it is.
You still see, like, the Prometheus Radio Project folks were there. They were giving a presentation on wireless and the potentials that it offers. They were helping people build cantennas to extend the range of their home, you know, Wi-Fi access nodes and things. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it was sort of an old home week, you know, catching up with the people that you saw last year. But at the same time, it also brought out people who were not specifically media makers, who were social justice activists, who were literally, you know, and legitimately asking, well, how can we figure out ways to interface and pool our resources and help change the world in a positive manner? And I think in that regard, a lot was done.
And maybe that is the frontier that we're looking at, because I think that the grassroots and independent media community across North America, at the very least, has done a good job in the last, I would say, six, 7 years since the Battle of Seattle, but even a little bit before that, in helping to congeal a bit and make connections and make networks across the country, so that, you know, an outpost like Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, which a lot of people across this country have never heard of, actually is a pretty big hotbed of independent media making. And we've brought, you know, Prometheus has been here. All these different organizations have actually been through this town all within the last 12 months.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen Democracy Now! Has been through here and so on. And maybe that is the next frontier, is then turning around and saying, okay, we're connecting up more or less. How can we make ourselves accessible to the people who are not so much interested in becoming media makers, but really have messages and things that they need to get out via independent and grassroots media?
Yeah, and I mean, that's something that definitely is kind of a logical evolution, so to speak. I mean, a lot of people involved in independent media making work very hard to get the tools together to allow people like other activists to make their own media. However, other activists who are not specifically engaged in the aspect of independent media making treat independent media as any other media source. So they send out a news release and they expect indie media to cover it. And that's not really, you know, the whole point of independent media is to enable people to tell their own stories. And so there hasn't been a lot of outreach and education and literacy work
done
on that front. And I think that this conference and a lot of other conferences and a lot of other developments happening around the country just represent a natural evolution where the maturity of independent media organizations, like more established, longer standing independent media centers and things, are now comfortable in their own skin that they can start to do that type of outreach and possibly act, and I put that in quotes, a little more like journalists, in that, you know, they will go out and cover other people's stories for their own news organization.
Or maybe everyone can meet in the middle somewhere where there's a little bit of, we really want you to speak more unfiltered without having, you know, to be subjected to having a 15-second soundbite taken out of your three-hour presentation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're going to have to think in those in that manner as well. Because what amazes me to some extent is in working with the mainstream media, a lot of activist organizations and social justice organizations have to put in probably 10 times, 20 times the effort for every second of coverage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you may only get 15 seconds on CNN or 15 seconds on the local TV news, or maybe a minute or two if you're lucky, or maybe a column inch in a newspaper, for which you will have to work very hard compared to being able to create your own message. But then again, I think expecting these organizations to become fluent media makers, practice media makers, is also taking them away from the goals that they're working for to begin with. So, I didn't expect this debate to come up, but this whole subject to come up, but it just kind of came out of your discussion there of what they're doing in New York City and what could potentially be done elsewhere.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't really see it as something that's limiting or anything like that. I look at it in a positive sense in that it represents, I think, an aspect of maturity among independent media makers, and it also represents an aspect of maturity among social justice activists. And now it's time to do the dance and figure out how both sides can kind of, and I want to say both sides, but you know, both camps, I guess, can work together and accommodate each other without having to do the complete and utter crossover thing where a social justice activist becomes an independent media maker and has to learn everything, and an independent media maker suddenly has to learn everything about whatever the activist that they're working with or for is doing. So it's just something that comes, I think, with time and like I said,
and talking, and probably a lot of just sitting around and talking, get to know each other,
planting seeds. We had a great post conference party at a squat in the East Village. It was really fun. And
which one did you go to?
ABC No Rio.
ABC No Rio. Yeah, it's very famous.
And
which is not so much a squat anymore, and that they have some rights to where they are.
Yeah, they just filled in the hole to the outer wall now, so it was nice because it got kind of cold and snowy.
But they gained those rights through squatting,
right? So it's great. It was fun.
And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at a world of grassroots and independent media. My name is Paul Reisman. I'm your host. My guest today is John Anderson from DIYmedia.net and Free Press's Media Minutes, a weekly news roundup at the intersection of media and democracy, heard on many community and public radio stations around the country. And you've even gotten down into like Australia and New Zealand. Is that correct?
Yeah, we picked up affiliates there.
The Kiwis and the Aussies are getting all filled in on the intricacies of American media policy, and can be heard in Champaign-Urbana as part of Bob McChesney's Media Matters program, which airs Sundays on WILL-AM 580 at 1 p.m. Central Time. And you can listen to it on the web during that program at WILL.UIUC.edu or at freepress.net. So let's go to the main topic here. It's something called HD radio, digital radio, also to those of us who've been known about it for the last 10 years, IBOC radio. And I actually had a listener who emailed me about a week ago asking me, you know, I'm looking into buying an HD radio, a digital radio, and I noticed that there aren't so many of them out there that can receive the HD signals. And there's this particular one, a Boston Acoustics. It's about $300.
Mm-hmm.
He said, is it worth buying a $300 radio to get high-definition radio right now? Or is that something I should wait on? What would you tell him? I'll tell you what I told him.
I would say no. I would wait for more receiver manufacturers to start making radios. It's really an interesting story because the receiver manufacturers have essentially been waiting on the broadcast industry to get its stuff together.
So it's the old chicken and egg thing.
Yeah. The broadcast industry has been developing this HD radio standard that we're using here in the United States for the last, well, it's actually really only been under development for the last 9 years, but the rulemaking and the policy extends all the way back to 1990. But they weren't actually able to come up with a final standard until about 2002. So receiver manufacturer, and it's been tweaked since then. So receiver manufacturers started to develop the chipsets and everything that needed to be developed to have an HD radio receiver. And then the company behind the HD radio standard would be like, oh, we're going to change a part of it. And then they would have to kind of figure everything out. And that has not only stymied the development of more radios, but it's also made receiver manufacturers not very happy about rolling, you know, these things out.
Right. Now, so you've been doing a year-long research project on this whole issue. So maybe you can summarize very quickly what I mean, it's only been called HD radio recently, yeah. I've noticed, and I'm sure it's by association to high definition television.
Right.
So maybe you can say more about what is this beast?
Well, HD radio is digital radio. It's instead of the analog signals that radio stations send out, they'll begin sending out streams of ones and zeros over the airwaves that you currently hear radio signals on. The process, like I said, began in 1990, and initially, pretty much the entire world was looking at adopting a different type of digital radio standard. The rest of the world has gone with something called Eureka 147, which doesn't really mean much, except that all radio stations that operate within that framework move to a completely different section of the spectrum. And instead of like here where, you know, WEFT has its own channel, I work for the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center's Low Power FM station. They have their own channel on 104.5. Under the Eureka 147 system, all the stations are what are called multiplexed. They're all sent out over a common carrier over the airwaves, and each data stream within that carrier has the signal.
So it's a lot like the internet in a lot of ways.
It's a lot like the internet. And so when you tune in to a station through that regimen, your receiver looks for the little data flag that says which part of the carrier is the stream you want. Over here, because the military used the spectrum that Eureka 147 is broadcasting on, they did. They don't need more, but they did back when it all mattered and the industry had to pick a standard. The U.S. radio industry found that they had to figure out a different alternate system for broadcasting in digital, and what they came up with was something called IBOC, which stands for in-band on-channel. And what that essentially means is that radio stations will convert from analog to digital, but they will not move. They will stay on the frequencies that everyone's used to using them on. The problem is that digital radio takes bandwidth, analog radio takes bandwidth, and they can't transition directly from analog to digital without obsoleting everybody's receivers. So in the interim, what's essentially rolling out right now is not true HD radio. It's what's called a hybrid signal, where stations are still going to broadcast the analog signal that you're used to listening to, and then they basically, on the sides of that signal, put these digital sidebands which carry the HD radio programming.
Yeah, and when people are imagining this, you should really like think about the analog radio, which you've always, that probably everyone's, knows, and the whole where you see labeled out from 88 to 108, and you know, you get the little needle in the middle, mm-hmm. that's your station. Well, imagine that then you made that needle a little bit bigger, and that right. would represent its actual space. You can think of it in those terms, real estate on that dial, and IBOC is taking up just a little bit more in order to accommodate both the analog traditional radio signal and the digital. Now, what I've heard complaints about is that the digital sidebands create interference to adjoining stations, sometimes maybe distant stations yes. that you're trying to tune in.
Yes. Digital, like for an example on the FM side, if you notice the dial positions are separated by what are called 200 kilohertz. So it's 90.1, 90.3, 90.5. And so each station occupies that little 200 kilohertz chunk of bandwidth. IBOC signals or HD radio signals occupy 398 kilohertz of bandwidth, which means not only is the analog signal sitting in the middle of that, but then you have these sidebands which extend out. So if you're broadcasting on 90.1, your station's digital and audio hybrid signal is extending all the way to the channels next door.
To 90.3 and to 89.9.
Right. And so if there are stations located, you know, one channel away or even two channels away, they are prone to receiving interference from those digital
and there aren't supposed to be local stations on those frequencies under current spacing standards, but there could be a distance signal which you can generally hear pretty well,
right?
From a town or two away.
And the way that the stations are able to broadcast this expanded signal, which falls outside of what the FCC has actually allocated them for space on the dial, is they broadcast the digital sidebands at a power level 100 times lower than the analog channel. So not only do you not get full digital, you know, signal with a new HD radio receiver, you're also not going to be able to receive the digital portion of the signal within the same coverage area of the analog.
So whereas I might be able to receive a station from 50 miles away here very easily in the Midwest, an FM station, I probably won't get the digital part. I'll just
right.
get the analog portion.
You'll just get the analog part. And the receivers are set up to do something called blending, which is when a digital radio signal cuts out, like if you're listening to streaming audio audio online, and your streaming audio connection dies, the stream just stops. You don't really get interference or anything. It just stops, and then you get silence. That's how digital radio works. So to avoid that from happening, receivers have this blend-to-analog function where once the digital signal starts to drop out, you'll automatically be transitioned over, and you'll be listening to the analog signal again. And that's primarily how it works. The other interesting thing about digital radio as it's currently structured is that there isn't really a lot of bandwidth allocated to the digital signal. So all this talk that they say about how FM radio will sound as good as CD and AM radio will sound as good as FM is not really true.
It'll sound about as good as a decent web stream.
Right. It'll sound about as good as a decent web stream, about as good as your average quality MP3 file, but it's not going to be, you know, some sort of incredibly life-changing
right.
sonic
At
experience.
Its best, FM can sound very, very good.
And so can AM. If it's done well.
And most of the time it's not,
right. But
it can be. You are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media. Check us out online, www.mediageek.net. Get the radio show online in MP3 and Ogg Vorbis, radio.mediageek.net. I'm Paul Reichmandel, your host. I'm talking to John Anderson of DIYmedia.net and Free Press's Media Minutes. We're talking about digital radio, HD radio, also known as IBOC radio. So where are we in the evolution then here? So stations are now some stations are now broadcasting with so-called HD radio.
Mm-hmm.
Receivers have just started to come onto the market, though costing $300 and more each. And you know, compared to, say, like digital television, because President Bush just signed legislation that says analog TV goes black, goes silent in 2009 when we will be all digital. Are we anywhere close to that changeover in radio?
No. First of all, there's been no cutoff date set for digital radio. There was actually early on in the rulemaking proceeding in the early 90s, one of the proponents of the technology that has since been, you know, pretty much adopted and is being rolled out now, did want to set like a 12-year sunset provision. That was never actually enacted, and the FCC has been pretty much hands-off on this entire rulemaking.
They want the market to decide,
They want the market to decide, and they're letting the industry develop the standard without much oversight or even technical verification.
Which is very different than the digital television realm.
Yes. Back in, I think it was 2002 or 2003, the FCC adopted a tentative rulemaking, basically allowing stations to start rolling out this HD radio service. And Commissioner Michael Copps, one of the two Democrats on the committee on the commission, said in his public statement, "There is a lot we have yet to know about how digital radio works, including how it operates in the real world. But we're going to let you go ahead and put it on the air anyway."
So it's really kind of an experimental regime.
It is. And because, like I said before, stations that are adopting HD radio are not broadcasting in true digital. They're broadcasting in a digital analog hybrid mode. There is no compelling reason to basically make a cutoff date and to obsolete the several hundred million analog receivers that are out there right now.
And one of the problems people have had with IBOC, with that setup, is that it is actually, it's a completely privately owned technology. It's patented, owned by a single company. This is not a consortia. This is not like a lot of other this is not even like an MPEG standard, which is a part of an industry consortium. It is one company.
Yeah. It's a company called Ubiquiti Corporation, whose major backers do include all of the large broadcast conglomerates. You name
their investors.
They're investors, and they supplied manpower. They supplied people to actually populate the company when it was first founded. It was actually it's an amalgam of two companies that were basically working on competing standards and decided that they needed to join forces. One, which was essentially founded by CBS Westinghouse, and the other one founded by Lucent Technologies. And now Lucent still has a primary ownership stake in Ubiquiti, but the majority of the funding and the majority of the financial backing is coming from the radio industry itself. And like you said, this is actually the scariest part of this entire digital radio boondoggle, is that the technology is completely proprietary, which means going forward, any radio station that wants to broadcast in digital will require two licenses. Right now, WEFT requires only one license from the Federal Communications Commission to use the airwaves. In the digital future, stations will require a license from the FCC to access the airwaves, and then they will require a license from Ubiquiti Corporation to conduct the act of broadcasting. The license fees range anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000. That's an upfront single payment. And then you must pay recurring residual royalties if you decide to use any of the features that digital radio brings along. For example, digital radio is being rolled out now, and the killer application, as it were, that's being, you know, kind of hyped as the big thing that should entice people to buy digital radios is multicasting, where you can send more than one program stream over a single radio channel.
Now, with such a narrow digital bandwidth, though, I would say it sounds like there'd be diminishing returns on
how
many channels.
The audio quality isn't going to be that great, chances are you're going to have like one music and one talk channel, so that, you know, the bandwidth is conserved properly and everything sounds kind of okay. However, stations that want to use the multicast function of digital radio have to pay either $1,000 a year or 3% of any net revenue derived from that side channel.
So for like a WEFT, it would be $1,000, but if you're a big news talk station in a major market, that could be hundreds of thousands of
3%
dollars.
3% of whatever advertising revenue that you run on those channels.
Now, which is interesting, because my next question is going to be, so if the radio penetration is low, and this is not necessarily a technology that's ever going to take over, what's in it for them? And obviously, that's one of the big ones. What's in it for the broadcasters? Well, part of the spoils.
Yeah, they make money while making money. You know, they pay themselves essentially to use the standard, and they also get money.
And they get money from the radios,
right?
Because unlike like an FM or AM radio, any manufacturer from anywhere can come out and make a radio. They don't have to pay anyone necessarily anything to do so.
Right.
But if you want to make an HD radio, you have to pay into this consortium to pay the royalties on that.
Right. Basically, the way I look at HD radio is it's a placeholder technology. There is this compulsion among media to digitize. Digital is the next big thing. Everything must be digital. If it's not digital, it must suck. That's kind of the general theme. So, like, we have to go digital. We have this standard that kind of works, may not sound great, uses more spectrum than radio stations are currently allowed, but it's the best we got, and we have to do this. Otherwise, we're going to get killed by satellite radio. There was an industry trade publication who one of their reporters went into Kansas City Best Buy in Circuit City over the Christmas holiday, and he asked him for digital radio. I want to know more about digital radio, and they pointed him straight to XM and Sirius. So the conception of what radio is changing. And since HD radio is kind of one of these, you know, half-assed technologies, I think that it's just something that the radio industry is going to implement until they figure out a better way to use the spectrum. Once they figure out a better way to use the spectrum, I think that we'll start seeing radio broadcasters move away from the act of broadcasting toward the provisioning of other digital services like data casting, TV stations, for example. The big thing about digital TV was there's going to be six channels per each signal. Now the DTV stations are using it to offer movies on demand and subscription services.
Things that they can monetize more easily, more directly.
That do not serve the public interest,
right.
Do not provide free over-the-air programming, as was the license that they were given mandated them to do.
Yes. So digital, when you see the word digital used with regard to broadcasting, you should see the word money.
Yes.
Because that is what it is about. Not what's best for you, but what best lines the pockets of Viacom, Clear Channel, and their friends. John, thank you very much. Your website, DIYmedia.net, where you are keeping up on this issue. You're keeping up on the issue of digital TV. You've got a post from just a couple days ago there, as well as we cannot forget about your media collage archive, including truthful translations of our favorite politicians throughout the land.
It's all there. It's all fun.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowow. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.